Monday, January 18th, the first of the big days. I began it by going upstairs to have my second cup of coffee after breakfast with Lyndon, with Aunt Jessie and Ava Cox, to see if I couldn't lend a stole or a evening purse or maybe some gloves. These stolen nuggets of time with the kinfolks are one of the nicest things about this three-day marathon, because they're having such a wonderful time. Plane ride up was treat enough to make Aunt Jessie say, "I tell you, I may not ever get to Glory Land, but I feel like I've seen part of it." Then back downstairs for a long session with Jean-Louis, including a facial, the first I've had in a year, I think. Just as I was getting ready to eat a late lunch, about 2:30, Lyndon came over, so I had it with him. He's working on getting out 3 messages to Congress, and the business of the day must not be overshadowed by the pageantry of the day. And then, just before 3, the minute red silk Alaskan, which Candy made, putting on my fur hat at the last moment as a concession to Alex Rose, I left for the National Gallery of Art with Liz for the Distinguished Ladies Reception. As we rolled into the driveway, I saw Ida Mae Kane from Rochester and her daughter Stephanie Kane Delden, now from California, and that's the way it was all afternoon. Out of more than 5,000 ladies, I kept on seeing dear old friends from the far corners. There were 4 short receiving lines, and nobody knew who was going to be in which one. But in the marble elegance of the National Art Gallery, banked with azaleas and fountains, who ought to mind waiting? Marian Anderson was one of the first to come down the line. She's one of the Americans I admire most, and I'm delighted to think, by the way that she looks at me, that she likes me too. Wives of diplomats had been asked to come in their native dress. A troop of them came down my receiving line, each with a personal hostess. There were graceful saris from Nepal, a flowing blue and silver boubou from Niger, and one from Senegal that reminded me of the enormous poofs of nylon imported from Paris that I saw in Senegal when I was there for the independence celebration. The prettiest costume of all, and one of the prettiest women, so many of them are, was a red silk slitted gown over long black trousers from Vietnam. One of the columnists later rather snidely remarked, "Madame Hervé Enfant, wife of the French ambassador, came in her native costume too, a black tunic top shift by Pierre Cardin." The same columnist took a dim view of the clothes of the General Assemblage. There were very few distinguished clothes among the distinguished ladies. It was an anything-goes kind of reception. Occasionally, someone looked just right in a Chanel suit or a neat black dress, but not often. I had so much fun seeing the folks I didn't notice their clothes. When Sarah Hughes came down the line, Mrs. Donald Russell of South Carolina and I had a big kiss for each other. In fact, by the time the evening was over, I looked like I had the measles. There were so many pink spots all over me. Anyway, Derby, visiting Patsy, came, but Patsy wasn't there because she was a hostess. So many of the young folks, Becky, Susan, Warren Lynn, Bertie Baldwin, the young daughters of many congressmen, were hostesses all over the gallery. Glamorous Ava Gabor, Becky's friend, drifted by, I noticed uneasily, in company with columnist Roland's pretty young wife. And who should be on my right helping the line move but dear June Irwin? All the 4 Browns came by in a phalanx. Alice, Maconda, Isabel, and Nancy, all looking darling. After 45 minutes, and I would really have loved to have stayed for hours, Catherine Long came to take my place, and I made a slow departure through the throng, walking through several galleries so that everybody whose hand I hadn't shaken, we could at least wave at each other, and seeing en route old friends from all the 50 states, including Virginia Durr. One more big kiss. I later found there wasn't anything to eat at this reception, but one guest said, "You can get hors d'oeuvres and a cocktail anywhere. But when do you have a chance to see Rembrandt, Picasso, and Lady Bird all at once?" Having in that place was an inspiration. I also saw some columnists said, half of the 5,000 ladies, it seemed, wore mink turbans, as did Mrs. Johnson. I don't know whether I'm setting it or following it. The great surprise of the day was that Hubert Humphrey, in typical Humphrey fashion, appeared in time to take his wife's place in line and gave all the ladies one of the big thrills of the whole 3 days. Back at the White House, I did a little more visiting with all my crew of little girls in Lucy's room, curled up on the sofa for a few minutes with General Warry Lynn. We talked about Lucy and her plans. She wants Warry Lynn to be one of our sponsors when she is baptized. Warry Lynn, no proselyter, is urging Lucy to wait and wait and to be very sure. Next on the agenda, in my white pot-au-soir dress, the glittering top by Roxanne of Winston's, I set out with Lyndon for the pre-gala dinners at the Showroom and the Sheraton Park, renamed for the occasion the Sheraton, Texas, because it's headquarters for all the Texans that can get in there. There were about 3,000 guests at the Sheraton, Texas, where John introduced us, and another 1,800 at the Showroom, all members of the President's Club. But this time, both the dinner and the gala were free by invitation of the Democratic National Committee in recognition of past help and in hope for future help. They were the briefest stops of all. We quickly wended our way through the tables, smiling and waving at all sides. Lyndon made brief, humorous remarks, ending up on a serious note. Now is the time for hope and for rededication. Hubert had gone to the two other pre-inaugural dinners. Lyndon Marks, who's handled it all so competently, drove with us. We were back at the White House in a short time for dinner of our own. The White House house guests were eating in three places tonight. Linda Bird and her special friends, Carolyn, Warry Lynn, and I believe Susan, in the family dining room on the second floor. Anybody that wanted to, such as Sam Houston and Aunt Jessie, on trays in their rooms. And the rest of us in the family dining room on the first floor. Tony Taylor's, the Bobbitts, the Alexanders, Sarah. Seeing Becky and Sarah reminded me of Pearl's party last night, given for many of our special friends, and practically blanketing the papers this morning. I had phoned her that we would be arriving too late to come, and of course our plane load of guests included many who had been invited to the party. But Linda and Dave had been there, Becky and Bobbitt very much in their element, Sarah, and practically the entire law firm of Clark, Thomas, and Winters, a sizable covey of Texas publishers. I guess I see the hand of Liz Carpenter at work. And of course, the home of Thornberrys. Lyndon and I arrived at the gala on time, which is more than about half of the audience did. So they convoyed us into the waiting room where the walls were hung with our predecessors, Kennedy's, Eisenhower's, Truman's, and galas of other days. Then, when the crowd was mostly at hand, we went in to hail to the chief and an impressive, although not wild, welcome into an armory made gay with millions of bright blue streamers from the ceiling, enormous bouquets of red, white, and blue balloons, old belligerent gilded eagles, and American flags, a ripple in a man-made breeze. It was a triumph of decoration. Richard Adler is the director of the whole thing, and he had accumulated a galaxy of stars, so great that it caused two Broadway shows to close down. Harold Channing came down from Hello Dolly to be one of the MCs. Barbara Streisand from Funny Girl to sing. Dame Margot Fontaine from England's Royal Ballet flew over from London with her partner, who looks like one of the Beatles. At least one or two TV shows changed their plans. Alfred Hitchcock came to be MC and turned out to be practically the lion of the evening. And Woody Allen, that forlorn, undernourished little comedian, stopped shooting a movie, I think it was in Paris, and came over for about 5 minutes of jokes that I found hilarious, and I'm no lover of comedy on the stage. He looks like you want to give him a blood transfusion. But his monologue about the man who shot the moose strapped him to his car, and the moose came too in the Holland Tunnel. So the man decided to take him to where he knew there was a costume ball going on and introduced the moose. That muttered gesture I've used so often. You know the Solomonsons, don't you? Because he didn't want to say, this is a moose. Julie Andrews and Carol Burnett sang a wonderful medley of show songs, ranging all the way back to Naughty Marietta and up through My Fair Lady. And Harry Belafonte won everybody with Michael Row the Boat Ashore and that sad, nostalgic song about September. Exquisite and perfect as Margot Fontaine was, it was a foil at the opposite end of the dancing spectrum. It was just as good as she was, a member of the Mexican Folklorico, a dancer with a deer head, complete with antlers, strapped to his own head, who portrayed a deer that has been shot in its dying struggle. He was so fierce, so animal, so true to nature. To me, the most startling performance of the evening. And Bobby Darin sang a song, which he said, the Army Reserve dedicated to the Secretary of Defense, Mac the Knife. One of the few allusions to the contemporary political scene. Another was Hitchcock's message ostensibly addressed to the GOP on last November the 4th. Good evening, friends. Do you have that morning after feeling? Did you feel your group had all the cavities? It was a magnificent evening. I've never seen a better. One thing was lacking, and that was audience response. It was a rather cold audience. Maybe it's the huge armory. But I was sensitive and on edge for Richard Adler and all the performers, and it was a bit long. There wasn't a thing we could have done without. When it was over, I went to the same room that we had started in. I was still carrying my bouquet of lovely white orchids which Sally Ann Howes, Mrs. Richard Adler, had welcomed me with. And in came all the performers, which gave us a chance to thank them. And what a lot it was to thank them for. Canceling performances for which they got thousands, flying across the ocean. I was as thrilled as Linda and Lucy to meet them and to tell Julie Andrews the songs from Mary Poppins were the favorite Just Between Us conversation for me and Linda now. Harry Belafonte is just as agreeable in person as on the stage, a man of joy. Linda stayed to go to Mrs. Kafrich's party, and Linda and I reached home early, about 12:30, grateful that at least one day had gotten by without snow, although on Sunday, when the thermometer dropped to 10, the lowest temperature of the year, and the city had 3 or 4 inches of snow. Everybody had braced themselves for a repeat of the 1961 snowstorms, each telling the other that the Farmer's Almanac usually turned out right, and it said 30 inches of snow during January.